Yo, yo, it's your boy OG Arabian Prince from the world's most dangerous group, NWA, and you're listening to Rebel Radio. And if you ain't a rebel, you need to be a rebel on Rebel Radio. Yeah. Fuck you, Josh.
What's up? This is Rebel Radio.
What up? What up? This is DJ Newmark.
This is Peanut Butter Wolf.
It's your boy. It's okay.
Keep checking out Rebel Radio.
Rebel Radio.
This is Rebel Radio.
We're in the place right here. Rebel Radio is going down.
What did you say, Rebel Radio?
Oh, wait. Let's do it again.
Rebel Radio.
What's up, Rebels? Welcome back to Rebel Radio, the weekly show where I bring you the rebels who are shaping our culture. I'm your host, Josh Levine. This week, we have a very special guest, the OG Arabian Prince. He was a co-founder of NWA. He has a long career as a solo artist and producer. He's been involved in animation and the movie business. He's a tech entrepreneur. He's got a new venture that I want you to check out called Covatech, where that he's co-founded, and he's providing PPE and other COVID support to small to medium-sized businesses. Really cool thing happening there. And we have just a great conversation. We talk about music, of course, and a lot of the shared love we have for that. We get into some race, some politics. Obviously, man coming from NWA and who's been through as much as he's seen. I wanted to really dig into his perspective on a lot of that. And then, as you'll see, you know, he had a very clear vision for the business, and he's got some good lessons on how that's carried him through the decisions he's made over the years. So it's a great interview. I'm excited to share it with you. Let's get into it.
You know, we did a song that talked about an issue, and no one really listened to us back then. They listening to it now, you know, 30-some years later. But it's like people are going to use it both ways. And it's just
for sure,
whatever it is. And then if you have an opinion, to state your opinion to make you feel better, and so people know where you stand. But people, you know, music is free for the people. So
that's right. Yeah. Well, let's dig into that,
okay,
man. I'm excited to finally meet you.
Yeah, for sure.
You know, I've been following you forever. I still got my copy of She's Got a Big Posse.
Wow.
Somewhere around here.
Yeah.
And obviously, you know, us being neighbors. So, take me back to the very beginning. Do you remember the first record you ever bought?
Yeah, you know, it's funny you asked that question. I just did something for a thing in Germany, and I had to do all these B-sides, and we talked about that. The first record, I was actually with my boy, Egyptian Lover, and I had just got my car. Like, I was 16 years old, and now, mind you, this is the first record I bought. Mm-hmm. Like, I had vinyl acquired from people, but I'm like, I got my car. We're going to Tower Records on Sunset, right? And my car was a 76 Mercury Capri with a stick shift. And what I didn't know is when you go up La Cienega, right before you get the Sunset, you know, I got that hill?
Yeah, man.
Oh, man. So we got on that hill, and I was like, and I got stopped like halfway up. And I'm like, I'm talking to each of them, like, what do I do? I said, just gun it. So I ended up getting there. Anyway, long story short, my first records, it was a few. I remember buying Depeche Mode, ABC, Look of Love, and Grace Jones, like, Pull Up to the Bumper.
Oh, wow.
Those were my first, like, vinyl, because they were 12 inches, and I was getting them. And back in the early 80s, when I started DJing, rap had just started. Everything was, you know, you were a DJ, you play pop. You played whatever was on the radio.
For sure.
Top 40, so.
For sure. That's great, man. That's a great start. I mean, those songs.
Yeah.
It's funny, you know, because I was thinking about, you know, you and your history, and, you know, I think the average person sort of thinks as NWA as the beginning of West Coast rap.
Right.
Right. I don't know, like, and obviously we know, you know, there was a rich culture, you know, with King T and Toddy T and Mixmaster Spade and you know, Wrecking Crew and what you were doing with JJ Fad and you know, all, like, there was a lot.
There was a lot before that. Yeah,
people obviously Ice-T.
Right.
But But then all of a sudden, like, NWA happens and kind of like overshadows everything else that was going on. And it's interesting. Well, so, you know, what I was thinking about is, like, you were making a different type of music, and Dre, and like, yeah, it was more of that electro thing, right? It was b-boy, right, music.
Yeah.
And even out, you know, I was talking to somebody on Facebook the other day about Reckless, and like how Ice-T is known for something totally different, but right, to me, that's one of the b-boy classics of all time, right? Like, and so I'm wondering, what did that teach you about just the way that trends change?
You know what? It's the inner cities. Like, you know, when you're young, you follow the trends. Like, even today, mm-hmm, you know, the music changes with the culture. And when we were young, when we were born, it was the disco kind of, you know, R&B soul era.
Mm-hmm.
And then when we got in elementary school, then it was like, we were talking about the Depeche Modes, it was the punk, the ska, you know, the top 40, all of that stuff, along with funk and all of that kind of thing. But then pop locking, breaking, you know, Electric Boogaloo, that whole thing, that was us. That was like what we were into. So that's what we were doing. And then when the whole thing, we saw the change, like with Uncle Jam's Army, I used to DJ with Egyptian Lover and all those cats, we would do all the dances. We saw the shift from party music to gangster rap, because the gang thing started to happen, and that changed the culture, and that changed the mood of the city. So we changed with the mood of the city.
Sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. So how'd you get started? So you were DJing first?
Yeah, I was, like, my father had a talk radio show on KACE Radio in L.A.
Okay.
And I used to go down there when he had the talk radio show on the weekend. I think it was Sunday, because none of the DJs were, Sunday was like all talk radio. So I got to sit in the other control room where the DJs would do the music stuff, and would play with that at like 12, 13, 14 years old, and became like really good at mixing and doing little mixtapes, and I would sell them at school. So everybody identified me as the DJ, and then I started doing the little school dances from there. And, you know, that was my history, is doing that. And I talked some guy into letting me have my own little teen club called The Cave over in Lenox. And yeah, that's how I came up. And a lot of the DJs who became the big radio cats and doing music, like Dre and Egypt and all of us, used to come to my little club. And that's how we got started.
Mm-hmm. And then how did that turn into producing?
Yeah, so that was even crazier, because Egypt and Uncle Jam's Army had bought an 808 drum machine, and nobody knew how to use it. So Egypt had it at his house, and I would go by there, and we'd mess around with it. And because of that drum machine, when they would do shows, DJing shows, they would play the drum machine, and people would keep dancing, and then they would chant on top of it and say stuff, you know. And from that, they were like, man, we could probably make a record, because people don't know the difference.
Sure.
And they say, I know, they're like, hey, man, we're gonna make a record. I'm like, what? And then I used to hang out with Dre and Yella and Lonzo from the Wrecking Crew as well, and they were like, we about to make a record. I'm like, but I wasn't really in a crew. I was down with everybody. I was down with them. I was down with, you know, the Wrecking Crew. I was down with, like, even the LA Dream Team. I did stuff with everybody. I was like the little tech dude that knew how to run all the stuff, so everybody would hang out with me. And I'm like, well, shit, I want to make a record too. So I ended up saving up $500 and getting some money from a dude I worked for, and going in the studio by myself, man, and figuring it out on my own. Like, I had never been in a recording studio. My mom's was a piano teacher, so I knew how to play, but I had never done anything, and went in the studio and made my first song called Strange Life.
It's funny. So my boy James Andrews likes to say that that the DJs were the first tech entrepreneurs.
Yeah.
Right? And because, you know, you had to be able to make the equipment work, and you had to figure out stuff that, you know, and we didn't have Splice and, you know, FL Studio and all this stuff that we do now, that, you know, my 10-year-old can make a beat. But you had to really be in there and figuring stuff out. So, you know, I know you work, I'm jumping ahead a little bit, but I know you're really involved in tech
right
now. What do you see as the similarities?
Well, for me, the similarity was this. And I tell people today, you can pick up an iPad or your cell phone and make beats and do music or whatever you want. When we started, if you weren't, and I'm not trying to do disservice to, you know, digital producers at all, because I'm a, you know, electronic producer. Mm-hmm. Unless you were a real musician, I mean, played a drum, bass, guitar, piano, something like that, in order for you to create a song, you literally needed to learn technology, because you had to learn how to work a sequencer. You had to learn MIDI and SMPTE and even something called CV gate that a lot of people don't even know about. You had to be able to sync all this stuff together to a 24-track tape recorder to be able to do that. And it was hard to do in the 80s. And we had to learn that. And when you learn that, that was some technological knowledge that you could take into other stuff. Mm-hmm. And once I got into it, it was like, well, I had to get a computer to do this. Oh, now I got a computer. Let me teach myself coding. Mm. Oh, I can do animation, sprite animation, and then eventually 3D animation. So a lot of things, I was doing other stuff with the computers than only music. And I was really passionate about video games. So I've been actually working on video games since the late 80s. So, you know, I got in early. Yeah.
That's crazy. Check it out, y'all. I'm excited to welcome a new sponsor to the show. This one's great. I have suffered from allergies my entire life, as a kid, as an adult. I've been to pretty much every type of specialist you can think of, from natural remedies to medicine to I haven't gone to see a witch doctor. Maybe that's next. Anyway, so, you know, I'm very concerned about my health. I do a lot to try to take care of myself. And, you know, more recently, I've become really excited about testing, because I found that I can get information that tells me about what's going on in my body and my health, and I can use that to make choices in my life. So help me welcome Everly Well to the show. Everly Well offers over 30 at-home lab tests. I just signed up for the allergy test. Like I said, that's been an issue for me, but they have all kind of other things. They have food sensitivity, STDs, if that's your thing, you know, heart health, metabolism, testosterone, so many different things. The test is shipped to your door, comes with really easy to follow instructions. I ordered mine. It showed up to my house. I did the sample, sent it off. It took me less than 5 minutes to do the whole thing. Could not have been easier. Once you send it back, they process it in a certified lab and they send you the results within just days. I'm waiting on my results now. I might share them with you depending on what it says. It might be private. I don't know. Let's find out. But I'm excited to get it back. They have a digital platform that breaks down exactly what the results mean for you. So if you want to start learning more about your health like I did, check out Everly Well at-home lab test today. For 20% off an Everly Well at-home lab test, visit everlywell.com/rebelradio and use the code rebelradio. That's everlywell.com/rebelradio, code rebelradio, for 20% off your tests. Everly Well at-home lab test, your answers your way. So you made Strange Love.
Yeah.
And then, you know, obviously we know the NWA story. Yeah. So you left over the business.
Yeah, I left over the business, man. Our manager, Jerry Heller, you know, got involved. Our NWA union was very simple. It was a bunch of homies that got together and started making music. You know, there were no contracts between us. It was just an understanding. Like, we get together, we go in the studio, we do music, and then everybody shares in the wealth. Like, here's your boxes of records, here's your boxes of records, here's your cassettes. You go out and sell them. Whatever you make from that, that's your money.
Right.
Hey, that's easy. But then when we got structure and got a manager in place, those things changed and the greed took over, because all the money started going to him and the money wasn't coming the other way, and it was always an excuse why you couldn't get your money. Oh, well, you know, we need to do this. Oh, talk to Easy, or, you know, like, we had to go through that. And how I figured it out was the fact that I had JJ Fad Supersonic, a song that I had paid for and I had produced and put out, and it was already a hit.
Sure.
And I took it away from Dream Team Records because I was having some issues with payments over there, and brought it to Ruthless Records, which was supposed to be our record label. And I said, hey, let me bring this in here and we share in the success of this record to help build NWA and Ruthless Records and everything else. So I even, you know, allowed Dre and Yella's name to be put on it because we were a production team, even though I did the song by myself. And I wasn't getting paid from it. So I kept having questions about that, even more so than NWA, because we had just started that. And Jerry never had an answer for me. So I got me an attorney, went in there and took care of my business and left. And I remember telling Cube and Dre and them what was going on. And early on, they didn't really get it because of the fame. You know, fame kind of clouds you just a little bit. Everybody's having a good time. You're touring. You got a big record. You're getting a little bit of money, but it wasn't what you were supposed to be getting.
Right.
And after I did my deal and got paid, I think they kind of saw, like, hey, wait a minute. He got money. We need to take care of that, too. And that was kind of like the end of the group.
Yeah. So tell me about that decision. So you went off on your own.
Yeah.
I know you made some records, but then you, like you said, you started getting involved in other things.
Yeah.
So was there a moment where you're like, you know, I'm going to shift gears, or did it just happen? Like, I'm wondering, you know, like, we can look back at your career now. You've done all this amazing stuff in different industries.
Yeah.
But like, was that the plan from day one, or was it more just kind of let it flow?
No, it was day one, because I was doing it at the same time. But yeah. I always told people it wasn't cool and hip to be a gangster rapper or a rapper in general and be a tech nerd.
Right.
I was doing it, and a lot of people were watching me do it, and there was no social media, so you couldn't talk about it anyway.
Mm-hmm.
I was just making video games, and I did the, you know, the visual effects on the first season of the Power Rangers and Casper and Adam's Family, and then went on to motion pictures and television shows. And then I started doing video games. And I was doing this while I was touring and performing and making records. And I realized on the film and TV side and on the gaming side, they pay you a lot of money.
Sure.
And they pay you now.
Right.
Because they don't want any mess ups. They ain't trying to hide nothing. They like, here's, I had a what you would call a render farm way back then. Rendering animation for Saban for a lot of their shows. And I was making a gang of money just doing that. And it was kind of like it opened my eyes. Why am I chasing record companies to get a little bit of money when I'm doing this and I'm making a ton of money and, you know, just keep going and keep going? And I just started doing both. I said it almost turned out to be music I was doing for fun because it was so hard to get record companies to pay you.
Sure.
And I had the technology side as a full-blown career. Yeah.
Yeah, man. You know, the record business, the history of the record business is about shady contracts.
Yeah.
And
always has been. And it still is.
Financials.
Yeah. Still is, you know.
And it's funny because, you know, what you just said, like, you know, I remember, so I used to manage Dub C.
Yep.
Before that, when I, you know, I met him a couple years before that, I interviewed him for something, and he said, you know, he said, if I couldn't do music as a career, I would still make music every weekend.
Yeah.
Right. And I think that's it's a weird thing, right? Because you start out, every musician starts out working for free. And then at some point it becomes a business. And then usually the business gets fucked up.
Yeah.
And maybe it gets fixed, you know, later down the road or whatever. But I think, you know, we people who make music, not we, you.
Yeah.
Like, it's like, it seems like you can't not do it. But then at the same time, to try to do it as your career, your sole source of income, is like, now you're thrown into all this craziness that has nothing to do with the music.
Yeah, and I think, too, like, I teach music business classes now.
Oh, is
because
that right?
I teach for Point Blank Music Academy.
Oh, cool.
And it's one of those things, the reason I wanted to do the music business class is one thing that people forget when they get into the music business, they get into the music, but they forget about the business. Now,
I'm
like, there's another whole word in that, you know, thing, like,
that's right.
Music, business.
Yeah.
So you can't do half. You got to do the whole thing in order to be successful. And I'm really passionate about this next generation of upcoming creators that they need to understand you got to protect yourself, your music, and your business, because people will find any little in to take your money or keep your money or get a portion of your money, sure. You know, if you don't take care of it. So it's a crazy world.
Yeah. So you're involved in all these other businesses.
Yep.
And you know, you're like, how can I say it? Like, you have your own thing, but you're also Arabian Prince from NWA.
Right.
Right. And so how does it play out? I mean, we're now 30 years later.
Yeah.
However long it's been.
Damn, like 40 years later. It's crazy.
Yeah, I guess so. You know, like you said, the music, especially Fuck the Police, is maybe more relevant today than it's ever been, but it's never gone away.
Right.
So how do you decide when to make that kind of bring that more to the forefront of your story and what you're doing versus when to kind of like, I'm not saying hide it, but but you know, obviously it's not the entirety of your story either.
Nah, but it's all part of it. So what I've learned to do is, you know, and I take a quote from, you know, Donald Trump, right? I always like to quote him because he's always making quotes about things.
And, for sure.
And he's always like, we're at war. And he's at war with, you know, with everything. You know, he's war with COVID. He's at war with illegal aliens. And, you know, we're at war with people rights. And we're at war with segregation and poverty and all kind of things, man. And you got to attack them from all different sides. NWA, we attacked it head on, you know, with the police and what was happening in the inner cities and the wrongdoings and stuff like that. But now I have the opportunity, because of what I do in technology and education, to attack it from another side. So we got the younger generation out there on the streets now doing what we were doing 30 years ago.
Sure.
I don't need to be on the streets anymore doing that. But I want to make sure that I do my part with educating the next generation and making sure they're protected and making sure that they have the tools, you know, to make a career, mm-hmm. you know, whether it's in technology, whether it's in music or entertainment. Because one thing I say, you're going to have the people out there that loot and do those things because they're either idiots, but you got a lot of people out there doing it because they're hungry. They ain't got nothing.
For sure.
But the moment you get something, then you take that person out of that equation. I wasn't out there looting.
Right.
Because I got too much to lose.
Right.
So you give somebody something to lose, then they like, I ain't me. You didn't see too many rappers out there looting. You know what I'm saying? Because they've already crossed over.
Of course.
So my job is to try and cross over as many people as I possibly can so that they don't get caught up in that system.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And the big companies got to step up. And the problem I always have with the big companies, and I say it every day, and I talk to my partner companies, is everybody, when something goes on, they jump on and donate and check the box. Look what we've done. They get the return on the investment. They don't do it quietly. They do it to
remember. Oh, yeah, of course.
We gave $100 million. Look at us.
Right.
Check that box. But a month or two down the road, they quiet down and everything's back. Nah, my thing is, if you're going to jump on this train that's moving so fast, you can't hop off. You on for the whole ride. And you, in order to keep this thing going and moving fast, you got to stay on the ride. And that's what I'm out there, you know, preaching.
So help me solve that, right? Because I have the same reaction. I see this company, you know, we saw all the black squares on everybody's Instagram, you know, last week or a couple weeks ago. The donations, there's a bunch of promotions, right? If it's a good time to be a black executive in corporate America, let me say, it's a better time,
right?
Than it was 2 months ago, right? Because you're probably going to get promoted in a very high profile way with a press release and all of that, right? But usually that's it. Like you said, they want to jump off that train and get back to making money, right?
Yeah.
What should they do? What do you want to see them do?
I just want to see them be fair about it. Like, don't hire somebody just because they're black, just because they're a person of color or a minority or something like that. But at the same time, look not only at that one person, look at your whole department and see how many people you might have passed over because of something. Like, man, like, this dude been here for a while and he's been kicking ass, but people have been passing him up. Let me go research that. Let me go do my due diligence and see if there was some wrongdoing within my department or within my companies, and try to rectify it and make sure that that never happens again. Like, my whole thing is, I'm proud to be black. I'm proud to have been part of a movement and to still be part of a movement. But all that anybody on this planet wants who is a minority is to be treated equal. You know what I'm saying? Like, just look at me as a human being.
Mm-hmm.
Look at me as exactly like you. If I'm smarter than you, if I'm better suited for something than you, I should be able to get it and not you.
Of course.
And that's all that anybody's asking. But people try to twist that, like, oh, here you go now. All the black people going to get promoted and this and that because of this. It's not because of that. It should be because it shouldn't even be a statement like that. It should just be like, hey, let's just put everything on a level playing field and try to monitor that.
Yeah, I agree. And I think it's, you know, it's such a convoluted argument, right?
Yeah.
Like, meaning, you know, back to what you just said. Well, how many people got promoted, got hired just because they were white?
Yeah.
Just because they came from a certain school, you know, that had racially biased admission policies, right? So, you know, at a certain point, you know, the entire Harvard, you know, graduating class was white, and then those people got good jobs, and et cetera, right? So it's not, I guess what I'm saying is, like, you know, we're never starting with a clean slate.
No.
We have centuries and, you know, of history that's gotten us to this point.
Yeah, and bias and systematic racism. Because I said something, and I'm not going to mention the companies or, you know, what I'm talking about, but let's say, okay, somebody came to me and said, like, I'm looking for somebody for this position. I'm like, I know the person that's perfect for that. And I says, you just got to take them how they are. But this is the guy you want, you know. And they didn't take that guy because he didn't wear a suit and a tie.
Mm-hmm.
And he didn't look like a person that could have been a CEO of this particular company.
Sure.
They got a guy who had a suit and tie, who had a college degree, but knew nothing about dealing with the issues that they needed.
Right.
And it's not going to work.
Sure.
You know what I mean? If you got to go, if you want somebody to build a swimming pool for you, you got to find somebody who knows how to build swimming pools. Not somebody who looks like they know how to build swimming pools. You know, you got to find somebody who knows how to do it. So,
But that's why I say it's complicated, because, you know, look, some things are not complicated.
Right.
Right. You know, cops shouldn't be killing people other than a last resort.
Right.
Right. I think there's certain lines that are really easy to draw. Other lines, you know, what you're talking about is like, is the issue of bias, of prejudice, right? And sometimes that's racial, but sometimes it can be so many things. You know, there's statistics that, like, taller people, there's more CEOs over 6 feet.
Right.
Right? And, like, that's a crazy, there's no systemic prejudice against short people.
Right, right.
But there's something in people's brains.
Yeah. This person has more of a presence.
Absolutely.
Right. There you go.
Right?
Yeah.
And so, and I'm not, you know, anybody listening, I'm not equating.
Take it away. Yeah, I understand.
You know, blah, blah, blah. Right.
Right?
But I'm saying that there's bias in everything.
Yeah.
Right. And I think, you know, and so when we talk about these movements or this moment we're having, you know, what I find is that, like, there's work to be done to get a common understanding of what's the goal. Right. Because ridding the world of bias is not realistic.
Yeah.
Right. Because there's all this bias that we don't even realize we have, or that, you know, whatever. I look at you in a red sweatshirt and I feel a certain type of way depending on,
right,
you know. So, and that's never going to go away.
Right.
Right. And we can each work on ourselves to get better at it, et cetera, but it's never going to be eliminated. And so that's where I see, you know, I'm curious about, with what's happening in the world, like, where is all this going to take us?
Yeah.
Right. Right now, you know, as we're talking, you know, Aunt Jemima pancake syrup is coming off the show.
Yeah, man.
Right?
So I want to talk about that. Can we talk about that one for a minute? See, now, can y'all ask somebody before you get rid of Aunt Jemima? Come on. Now, I heard they already fixed her once. Like, they took the little do-rag off her head and made her look better. I was happy about that. But, you know, like, certain things, like, leave her on the bottom. We don't have enough black people on bottles as it is. You know, change your name to Aunt Johnson or something if you worried about this. That's that thing.
Right.
But don't just get rid of it, because, I mean, I think certain things are okay. You know, even though it may have started off wrong, you guys did something to correct it, we get it. You know, but I think sometimes people want to go too far and over the top, and just bring somebody in and do a
For
poll.
Sure.
Do a poll. Like, ask a black person. Like, get the right one, you know. But
well, that's the thing, right, is so, you know, let's assume – you know, I want to give them the benefit of the doubt, but not too much.
Yeah.
I'm assuming they're trying to do the right thing in this moment
to do the right thing.
And then get off the train, right?
Yeah.
And get back to business,
right?
And, you know, and if you look at my feed, there's some people that are like, well, it's too late.
Yeah.
We don't fuck with you no matter what you do. And, which is also like, I mean, what do you want, right?
Yeah.
You, like, can nobody ever be redeemed because
I think people can
they didn't
be.
Get it right from the beginning?
Yeah. I think, you know what? Snoop Dogg said something a week or two ago, because, you know, he's real critical of Trump, and he said something about, because he just realized that he could vote. You know, Snoop was like, man, I can vote.
Oh, yeah.
I didn't know I could vote. And he said something, and I hope I'm quoting him close to what he was saying, that, you know, I understand if you voted for Trump the first time, that's cool, but if you vote for him again, fuck you.
Right.
You know what I'm saying? Like, now that you see who you dealing with.
Right.
Nobody knew back then what was going to happen. They just, it's Trump, he's, you know, blah, blah, blah. Let's give him a try because he's not a politician.
Mm-hmm.
But now that you see what he's about, if you voting for him, fuck you. And that's what, you know, Snoop said. And it's kind of that. Like, if somebody did something wrong, okay, good example. They brought Shaq in to Papa John's,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
And Shaq was saying, because I've been following his new show, about people been sending him hate mail and saying, how could you do this? How he said, because I'm here to change.
Yeah.
I'm here to make change. I came in to fix this.
Right.
What do you want us to just alienate it? Nah, we got to fix these things. And that's my point, is I'm trying to figure out, if everybody does a little bit of something, can't nobody fix the whole thing. This mm-hmm. may never get fixed to the end of time, because like you said, there's going to be bias to the end of time. But if I can fix a piece, somebody else can fix a piece. And we can save a life here, save a life there, change the way somebody thinks here and there, then eventually we'll get there. And I often say this, and I'm old, you know, I say this, all us old people are going to eventually die, who are probably most of the problem. Most of the problem is the old people that
For sure.
have been here forever. Once all of these old politicians die off and the younger generation comes up with their utopia, there's going to be a huge change. And this is the thing. What we're seeing now is the beginning of that.
Yeah.
You know, and I think it's going to happen. We all got to do our little bit of a part.
No, I think you're right. And it, you know, but the weird part of that is that, like, we seem to care, and we humans, like, we seem to care, like, college age.
Yeah.
Like, I remember, you know, I went to UCLA, there was, like, hunger strikes and shit on campus at the time. And I'm like, well, you guys care too much. Like, I don't even, but whatever, that was, but my point is, like, people get really active then in what's going on in their world, which is kind of like you wake up from being a kid, and as a kid you're totally in just your own thing, and then you look around, you go, oh, there's problems out there, right? And then we forget for our 20s, 30s, because we get busy with our own lives, we're trying to have families and careers or whatever. And then you see, you know, like you said, the politicians, they're in their 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s, like, and they're stuck in the old ways, right? And so I think, you know, part of it is what makes me happy right now is it seems like people in that 20s, 30s, 40s are starting to wake up and realize that they need to get involved with what's going on out there in the world. You know, at the same time, I remember, you know, I saw a clip last night from 92 when the news was asking Ren and Easy. No, it was Ren and Cube to, like, tell people to stop rioting.
Oh, yeah.
And Ren was like, what y'all want me to say? Like,
yeah.
But, you know, but also I'm like, this guy's 24. I don't know how old he was at the time. Like, how is he supposed to be, you know, how is he the role model that you're turning to tell people how to act, right?
Right.
Like, you know, I mean, you know, obviously you guys were in the public eye, you were celebrities at that point, but you're also still young men trying to figure out who you are.
Yeah.
And I don't know that, you know, I don't know that we should be looking to our young rappers to tell us how to act. I don't know. I'm not sure we should look at anybody to tell us
that. No. Like, even Dave Chappelle was like, y'all telling me to go say something. Like, right. What can I do? Like, right. Don't nobody want to hear from me.
Right.
It's their time now. Let them. I'm going to say what I'm going to say when it's time for me to say something. Or I'm going to do what I'm going to do to do my part of it. But yeah. Let them go do that. And I'll you know, everybody's going to handle it a little bit. I got some technology stuff I'm working on.
Yeah, tell me about that.
Oh, man. I got some new apps that we're doing. I partnered with some other tech and bio friends of mine, and we're doing this thing called Covertech,
okay,
a new company to help smaller companies, moms and pops, inner cities, to kind of get the stuff that they need during this COVID environment. Because that's another thing, big companies can get whatever they want, big governments can get whatever they want, but sure, inner cities, moms and pops can't get anything. So we want to help do that. And then I started looking at rights of people, and basically one of the problems is people don't know their rights when it comes to dealing with police officers. Not sure. even like security guards at like Walmart. You know what I mean? I'm seeing like incidents where like people get shot by security guards at Walmart,
yeah,
or stopped for different things. And if people knew their rights more, it could quell a lot of these incidents. And if even police, I'm finding out a lot of police don't even know the law. Mm-hmm. They assume,
right,
without actually knowing. And then when someone who knows the law opposes them, then it escalates because they get mad. And the person is saying, no, I'm just exercising my rights. If you don't call your superior and find out what I'm saying to you, don't get pissed off and try to harass me or harass me. Just if everybody is on the same playing field and understand, we can save a lot of people's lives. And that's one of my new issues right now, my newfound loves, is tackling that. Like, how can we get everybody on the same playing field? And I think that police officers and law enforcement in general want, just like us, when we was in school, we learned. As soon as you got out of school, you forgot everything you learned in school because you ain't using it.
Of course.
So same with police officers. They learn all this stuff. They read. Then when they go finish and they graduate and they get on the force, they're not recalling all of that legal information that they learned. And mm-hmm. I think that maybe that's part of it. There should be like weekly or monthly refresh courses on like, hey, okay, you're dealing with the public every day. Remember, these are their rights. These are things that y'all can't do, you know, and stuff like that. But they're not doing that. So yeah, we got to tell them. We got to, you know, there's got to be oversight, but there's also got to be technology companies and knowledge bases that are getting involved in this as well. So
if you're enjoying this one, let's go back into Rebel Radio Archives. One of my first interviews, another West Coast legend, my man AMG. We get in the studio talking about, you know, what it was like having a big hit record, a true underground hit record where there wasn't really radio play. There were, you know, videos didn't play the kind of role that they do today. And this man made it happen in the clubs and in the streets and exciting stuff. So go back and check that one out after you finish up here. What do you think? So you spend a lot of time with tech companies.
Yeah.
What should tech companies learn from the rap game and vice versa?
Well, one thing I say is go look to the inner city, man. Mm. And there's, I call it black gold, man. There's a lot of ideas and a lot of things coming out of the inner city, coming out of the rap game, you know, in general, coming out of athletes and entertainers that can help, that can make a lot of money, that can change things. A lot of big money goes into startup companies, and right, most of these startup companies are people coming out of colleges and universities. And, you know, the number is crazy that maybe 90% of every startup fails.
Yeah.
So you're talking about trillions of dollars or billions of dollars that just go down the toilet you know, and sure. give somebody else a shot. And if you look at, I always forget his name, the guy who's now the creative director for Louis Vuitton.
Virgil.
Virgil.
Yeah.
Virgil Abloh, right.
Yeah, yeah.
Where he came from, you know, yeah. and his design and building Off-White and mm-hmm. other people from the inner cities who create freaking massive, massive companies from nothing. No investments, no nothing. They just, right. because they're hungry. And I figure if you got somebody that's hungry and you give them a little bit of money or you give them resources, you're going to get a thousandfold out of something instead of giving $15 million to some kids out of college
yeah.
that may have an idea, but they're not really hungry.
But see, that sounds like the rap game to me. Like, I remember hearing, you know, one time that, you know, I think major labels, 95% of their releases lost money.
Yeah.
Right? And then they have 5% of the hits that, you know, cover everything cover else,
everything
right?
else. That's correct.
And I remember hearing that, like, well, how could that be a business, right? And but at the same time, right, if you, especially back then, if you looked in the streets, you guys were selling out of the trunk, too short of selling out of the trunk.
Yeah.
You know, nobody was losing money.
Nope, yeah.
Do you know what I'm saying? Like, you might have a small business, but it's still profitable.
Yeah.
You know, Master P doing his thing, right? And so it's not until the investors come in, the banks come in and start throwing money into things that things actually start losing money.
There you go. There you go. And that's what I said. You know, you go in the inner cities and you give a little bit of money and some structure and yeah. teach them how to build something and take it to that next level with the hustle yeah. side. Because, like, even me today, I don't need to penny pinch or save on stuff, but I've always done it. I've always figured out how to use intellectual properties to make me money without spending money, you know, no matter what I'm doing.
Mm-hmm.
And then I look at somebody else doing exactly the same thing. Oh, man, we just raised $20 million. What the hell for? And then you go to their office, their brand new office, and I tell students this all the time. I'm like, when I talk to startups, I'm like, don't buy a waterfall wall. And I tell this story. This is a funny story. So I go to this startup in Santa Monica. They had a party launching their new thing, showing mm-hmm. off their new office. I'm in there talking to somebody, and I'm leaning on the wall, and my arm is wet. I look over. I'm like, why is my arm wet? And I look up, and there's a waterfall rolling down the wall into some, like, rocks and some lights. Uh-huh. And I'm like, damn, how much does this cost? Like, they're a startup. They haven't even put their product out, but they got a waterfall wall. Their priorities are screwed. That's like two engineers that you could have paid for by doing this.
For sure.
So that's my mentality, is take the mentality of the inner cities. They building something from nothing
yeah.
and coming up. Look at all the rappers that's millionaires now. Look at all these social media influencers. That's little kids, 14-year-old kids is making millions of dollars.
Yeah.
Ain't nobody giving them no money. They figured it out. And I think big companies have to understand that there's other ways to, you know, make money.
Yeah. No, that's absolutely right.
Yeah.
How much are you still inspired by music?
Dude, every day. I still work on music every day. I'm actually working on, I did some stuff with, because I'm in all kind of music. If you listen to my music, it's not just hip hop. You know, sure. I'm in the dance, rock. I'm in everything, man. I'm just that dude. I love music. And I did some stuff with the group Ministry, Al mm-hmm. Jorgensen and Ministry, you know, crazy industrial rock. I don't even think he likes the word industrial rock, but he's just, you know, that's sure. my boy. And we did some stuff, and we talked last week, and I was like, man, I want to do something. Like, I want to say some stuff, like, on record, but I don't want to really do rap. You know, I just want to do something. So me and him are going to be working on something with Ministry and with Al Jorgensen.
We're
going to put some stuff out and just talk about what's going on right now. Because, you know, I got to say this. So ever since I was 12, 13, 14 years old, like, I grew up in Compton, and my mom's put me in Catholic school to keep me out of trouble. So, you know, people who know about Catholic school, actually, Catholic schools are worse than public schools, because I can say this too. You know, in public schools, the teachers and the faculty were kind of up on what was going on, because mm-hmm. it's a public school. They sure. got to be up on it.
Yeah.
Catholic schools, the nuns and priests didn't know what was going on, so we was doing all kind of dirt. Nobody yeah. knew. But walking home from school wearing Catholic school clothes, a tie, a green jacket, and some salt and pepper pants, at 13 years old, I was still getting pulled over by the police for no reason back then.
Yeah.
And from then until now, at the age of 55, to this day, I've been pulled over or stopped more than 200 times I can imagine. and I've only gotten one ticket. Yeah. Never been to jail. Been taken to jail because of NWA and some other crap, but never been to jail or been arrested. So that's got to say that there's something wrong. I pull up to my spot in my car sometime, and they pull up behind me going into my garage and make up something to ask me a question. So it's got to change, man. A lot of things got to change.
Absolutely. Everybody say I'm happy. If you try to hang with me, you should find it true. I'm always rocking, never stopping, devastating, rapper lady. When I'm on a microphone, it's either all these imitated figures or different. It's everybody say I'm different. There's no other angel lover. Everybody know I'm covered clientele. Clientele is a pearl. Everybody know in jail to the beast, so you can tell. Everybody know you fail. Oh, so you're talking about the music. So what?
Yeah.
What do you listen to?
It's funny, man. I like listening to old. So I'm a huge Kraftwerk guy still, and you know, rest in peace.
Yeah.
Florian Snyder. I'm a huge Parliament Funkadelic head. These are my influences. Prince, Kraftwerk, Parliament Funkadelic. So daily when I'm rolling in the car, that's like my playlist. I tune in to regular radio to kind of keep up on what's going on. But that's what I'm into. But recently, man, I've gone and been studying Sly Stone for the simple fact that, one, I feel sorry, man, on how his career ended, you know, because his drugs just took over with him, man. Yeah. And like, now he's still living and got ripped off. But talk about a genius, because his style of music was so different. He created this thing, and even when they talk about how he created things, he wasn't the greatest musician. He wasn't the greatest writer. Most of his songs kind of say the same thing over and over. It's not like he's writing even some deep lyrics. Yeah. He did, mind you. But I'm just saying, it was just this thing. And when I listened to it, the riffs he created. Like Larry Graham said that for If You Want Me to Stay, I thought Larry Graham did that bass line. No, it was Sly. Larry Graham said he was doing something. Sly came and said, nah, do this. And came up with this really intricate, over-the-top bass line that was not even something that a bass player would play. But because he wasn't a bass player, it worked. And I'm like, so that's what I like, is people just always creating outside the box.
I mean, it's interesting you mentioned Sly Stone and Prince.
Yeah.
Because I think there's, you know, I think Prince, there's a lot of Sly in Prince.
Oh, yeah. Oh, hell yeah, it is.
And it's funny, you know, Prince, it's hard to have an interview where Prince doesn't come up. Not to, you know, because I think his influence is so vast. Oh, yeah. Although he didn't understand hip hop until much later, or maybe at all.
Yeah.
But it's understandable. Yeah. That wasn't his world. Is that going to happen again?
Oh, another one of those kind of people. They're out there.
Are they?
You know, I'm following them and on social and on YouTube. I'm finding these little diamonds in the rough. Like I can't remember some of them names. Like I really felt, okay, so a friend of mine, uncle is oh my god, I'm on a keto diet, man. My brain don't work like it normally works when I'm on carbs. Like, no carbs will kill you. The horn player, oh man, the white horn player, that's dope.
Oh shit,
it's gonna come to me. I had to look it on my phone. But anyway, he's got his little sessions now where he does these little sessions.
Okay.
And there's this girl, man, from down in New Orleans that's like a jazz singer.
Mm-hmm.
Man, she's killing it, but she can sing anything, like on top of this, on top of that. So I'm following her. I'm following this girl named, what is her name, too? So I'm telling you, man, my brain right now, dog. It's she's the one that plays all her music by herself, and she loops it on stage.
That's cool.
And she's like freaking killing it, you know. Really? So I watch stuff like that, and then, you know, I just try to find something different, breath of fresh air in this, you know, world of commercialization of music.
Yeah, and that's what I worry about, right? Is you know, even NWA, right? Like, you know, Straight Outta Compton was the record that, you know, pushed it over the top,
right?
But, you know, how long had you guys been making music before that?
Oh my god, right? Like 5-6 years before that. Yeah.
And that's what, and so I think every musician that changed the world, right, in any significant kind of way, they had that 5 sometimes to 10 year period.
Yeah.
Right, where nobody really knew who they were, or they weren't who they were.
Yeah, the top of their game, right?
At the top, right? And so I think that period is necessary. And I don't know if musicians are being allowed to have that today.
Yeah.
Right? Because everybody finds out about you too quick.
Yeah, and they do. And then you have to, like, in order to be a hit, sometimes you got to fall into a category of what's hot right now. Yeah. Sure. And, oh, not to, oh, Tash Sultana.
Okay.
That's the girl.
Okay.
And then David Sanborn.
Oh, okay. Yeah,
yeah, those are the two names I was trying to come up with.
Nice.
It took a while to find them in the vault.
Nice.
But yeah, it's true, man. It's really, really true. And that's why I said, I think we got to get back to breaking the stereotypes, because, and I hate to sound like the old dude, like the uncles or your grandfather when you was young, like, yeah, when we went to school, we used to walk uphill both ways in the snow, you know, with no shoes.
Sure.
You know, I don't want to be that guy like that, yeah, when we were rappers, but it's true. When we were rapping and hip-hop first started, you could identify artists. You knew what the Beastie Boys sound like, yeah, what LL Cool J sound like, what NWA, what Public Enemy. Everybody had an identity. Mm-hmm. There was really never two artists that sounded alike.
Right.
Everybody had their thing. Now it's a lot harder to listen to music and understand who it is. You got to, who is that? And they, oh, okay. But I think I'm seeing a change, because on the EDM side, EDM has become a lot less epic. Remember, EDM used to be this epic thing,
sure,
with,
sure,
drops,
sure.
And then you had like this weird thing where you had like the Chainsmokers and Calvin Harris's, which were a lot different than the normal EDM. You,
yep,
had, you know, Skrillex, and you know, you got Marshmello. You got, it's a whole different environment on the EDM side now, right? That's changing things up.
Yeah.
And oh, one of our boys used to live in the building. He just moved out. Oh, my God. What was his name? Dr. Fresh. I don't know,
oh,
if,
yeah,
you know Dr. He used to live, yeah, in the building.
Is that right?
Yeah, he just moved.
Oh, that's funny.
He's parked right next to me. I didn't know. I thought he was this other cat named Slushy.
Okay.
Because he had green hair. And I'm looking at this fool. This fool got green hair.
That's
familiar.
Funny.
But, yeah, he's out there doing things. And the crazy thing about Dr. Fresh, I had never heard of him, right? And he's like, man, we got some synergy. I'm like, what? And he said, here, go check out this on YouTube. And he had taken Gangsta and remixed it,
oh wow,
into like this instrumental,
uh-huh,
and cutting up Easy's vocals, and had like AMGs in Russia, like, uh-huh, you know, driving crazy, man. That thing got like 90 million views.
Wow.
And I'm like, Gangsta didn't even get 90 million views. Like, damn. So it's a,
sure,
different world. Yeah,
yeah, for sure. Is there anything you miss about that time?
You know what I miss? I miss the fact that you could really, really engage with people personally back then. You know, especially being an artist, you would get off stage and talk to people and kind of just be out there. We used to do the smaller clubs. Even, mm-hmm, when we got big, you would go do the smaller, mm-hmm, events, or go,
mm-hmm,
you know, I remember we'd come off a tour and we would go to this place called Akasa in downtown LA and just fall in and be cool. I think a lot of artists can't do that no more. It's too dangerous. You,
yeah,
know, so much is going on, man. And I think that's going to change too, is just, you know, like crime in general, like black on black crime, or just, you know, hate. And man, that's just got to stop, man. I'm too old for it. And even as younger people kind of get it too. And everybody got a camera now. So I think that,
sure,
we're starting to see that people are going to see everything, and people got to, yeah, understand that you can't hide no more.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, you know, I think of all the shit we did as kids. It wasn't, you know, they might not have been felonies, but they're definitely things,
oh,
I don't,
yeah,
want on,
man,
camera.
Oh, yeah. No. It's crazy.
And we,
dude,
didn't have to think about that.
Yeah, you know? it's crazy.
Yeah, that's crazy. You know what I miss? I miss the, you know, and I'm a little, you know, I'm a step behind you.
Yeah.
But, you know, I miss the, there was a tight community. You know, and you talk about, you know, Egyptian Lover.
Yeah.
And which, by the way, I mean, just like, how game changing was that record when it came out?
Oh, yeah.
You know, I can still picture some. We were on the bus. I was in San Francisco. We were on the bus and somebody was playing it, and the whole bus just like,
yeah,
it was like a scene out of Fame.
Yeah, yeah.
Like everybody just started bugging out to this song.
Yeah.
But But there was a time when you could walk out of your house and you're seeing, you know, the community of people that were making culture happen in real time.
Right.
You know what I mean? Everywhere you went, you know, there was this producer and this DJ, and, you know, I bump into Battle Cat and I bump into, you know, whoever, right? And I don't think that exists anymore. I think it's too big.
There's
too many people.
Yeah. Yeah. It's too big.
And you know, like, it's great that it's gotten to where it is, but also, like, for me personally, I miss that.
Yeah.
I miss feeling like there's a tribe that, like, we're all kind of in it together.
Yeah, and in small ways it is. Like, every now and then people will get together, you know, like,
yeah.
I'm down with the Stone Throw crew.
Yeah.
You know, I'm down with the Battle Cats and them too as well. So every now and then everybody gets together. You know, like, we all, man, it was beautiful, like, at NAMM. Right before they shut everything down because of COVID, and no one knew COVID was lurking in.
Right.
Like, COVID, I went to CES and NAMM, so it was there, and I didn't get it, thank God. But we did what was that bowling alley out in Orange County? There's a bowling alley out there.
Oh, okay.
And they had a DJ event, and I mean, everybody was there, dude. People were showing up. I was like, oh, what?
Right.
That fool walked in, and it was just amazing to see everybody in the house together,
yeah,
you know, like spinning and DJing and stuff. So it was actually really cool.
Yeah, I mean, I had that at Tunes' funeral.
Yeah,
which is like, you know, it's a shame it has to be at a funeral.
Yeah,
but it, you know, to see everybody that you hadn't seen in 20 years, like, you know, pick it right back up.
Yeah, and I bumped into to Dub C at a concert in Santa Ana. I was doing something with JJ Fad, and he was there with Cube. I didn't catch Cube. But Dub C was there. I bumped into him, and then bumped into MC8 and a couple other people that I hadn't seen in like forever. So it's cool.
Yeah, it's cool.
We getting old.
Yeah, for sure. All right, I got to do a little lightning round.
Okay.
Before I let you get out of here.
Cool.
What's your favorite city to travel to?
Sweden and Japan. So right down the middle, 50-50, Sweden and Japan.
Dope. Those are two of my favorite places.
Yeah.
Who's your favorite DJ?
Qbert.
Yeah. You know, that's another one, right? That, you know, he just did shit that no one had thought of. You talk about Sly and
Prince.
Oh,
my God, dude. Yeah, I tell somebody, you know what's funny? I was watching Qbert do this event, and I was with some people. And I had to explain to them, because they were, like, perplexed the way they were looking. Because what he was doing probably didn't sound good to them, because they're used to the DJs doing the traditional scratches on the beat. I said, you don't understand what he's doing right now. He's like one third between this note and playing, and like, and he's bent. Like, it's like jazz what he's doing.
Mm-hmm.
And it may not sound good to you, but if you know what you're listening to, you know that that's impossible. You know, and that's why I love that cat.
Yeah. What's the last great book you read?
Man, the last great book I read, one of my father's books. I don't know if you know, my father wrote over 100 books.
Oh, damn.
Yeah, he was one of the most prolific black authors. He was the editor of Players Magazine as well.
Okay.
So I had a very interesting childhood growing up with that.
Nice.
But I've been going back and reading his book.
What's his name?
Joe Nozell.
Okay.
And he wrote any book that had black in it, he wrote it.
Okay.
Black Exorcist, Black Gestapo, Black Cop. You know, actually, he penned some of the stuff for Iceberg Slim. Some people say, Iceberg. My father worked for the same company that put out all the stuff for a lot of other people. But he was the guy that actually would sit down and pen all that stuff and type it out for him and, you know, turn it into format.
Yeah.
Because a lot of these cats who made books, they weren't writers.
Sure.
So my father was the one that did all that stuff.
Oh,
so
wow.
I was gonna say my pop's books, not being biased, but yeah.
Is there a favorite one?
My favorite one is still he wrote like a little small one on Magic Johnson. And for me, I love the Lakers and Magic.
Yeah,
and that's one of my favorite ones that he wrote.
Nice.
Yeah.
That's cool. You have to tell me about the Players Magazine stories another time. What movie have you seen the most in your life?
So that one is also split right down the middle, and it used to be just two, and now it's three, and people gonna think I'm corny as hell. One would be Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory. That's my favorite movie of all time.
Okay.
The fool is dark and crazy.
Yeah.
The original one, new Michael
the
Jackson.
Gene Wilder.
Not the Michael Jackson verse. That's what I call the new one. I look like Michael Jackson. That the Fifth Element.
Uh-huh.
Is just.
So,
the soundtrack, everything about that is my thing. And then I'm just a Harry Potter head, dude.
Is that like, right?
I don't care when Harry Potter comes on TV. I will stop what I'm doing to watch Harry Potter.
Okay.
And that's me.
That's funny.
Yeah.
She's in trouble right now, right? She said something.
Oh, yeah. She's on her own thing with the LGBT or transgenders and stuff. Man, my thing is, dude, just leave people alone. You know what I'm saying? We all on this planet. Leave people alone, man. Let people do what they do.
Yeah, but the thing is, like, Kubrick got into some trouble too, right?
Yeah.
And so, to me, it's like, well, you don't have to say anything.
Yeah. That's right? What I'm saying. Just leave people alone. If somebody come in my house and do something in my house or do something personally to me or say something personally to me, I'm gonna be like, all right, I'm going to deal with you personally.
Right.
I can't speak on a group of people. Like me, I can only give my opinion on black, on what's going on to us black people.
Sure.
I can give my opinion.
Right.
I can be part of a movement, but I'm only a small part of it.
Right.
I'm not about to speak up on Hispanics. I got a running joke, too. And nobody get mad at me because I'm part American Indian, too.
Okay.
So I'm like, I need my 40 acres in the mule and my casino. I need both. Like, can I get paid? You know what I'm saying? But
yeah.
I don't speak up on other people. And I think that's one of our biggest problems. You got people speaking up on other people. You know, I'm Catholic. I go to church sometime. I went to Catholic school my whole life. But, you know, whatever my values are, those are my values.
Right.
There's people around this world got different values. There are other religions in this world that we don't understand. Because they do that religion, am I supposed to be condemning them? But
sure.
Saying they're wrong? No. That's their religion. That's what they're about. Do they bother me? No. People are people, man. And once we get to the point to where people leave people alone, I think we'd be good.
But that's the challenge, right? Is like you give somebody, you know, you take a normal person, stick a camera in their face, and all of a sudden they're acting like an authority.
Yeah.
And we always have a camera in our face.
Yeah.
Right? And so J.K. Rowling or Q-Bert or whatever feels, and everybody else too,
right,
by the way, like feels entitled to speak like they're an authority on something when it's just their opinion and really who gives a fuck what you think.
Right. And I, you know, I even have my opinions on people. You find out people have done things and then people disown them.
Right.
So I've always adopted certain things. Like some things were part of my life. Like Bill Cosby, that was part of my life growing up. The Cosby Kids, the Cosby Show.
Of course.
Okay, so wrong what he did. I like that Bill Cosby. The Bill Cosby that he is now, or the things that he did that I didn't know about until I found out, I don't like that Bill Cosby.
Yeah.
But I like that Bill Cosby.
Yeah.
You know, and you can't.
Well, that's the thing. It's like, what are you supposed to, I mean, we can talk about that all day, right? Like, what are you supposed to go back to your child?
And erase.
To who you were as a child.
Yeah.
And erase those memories.
Because some of those things influenced who I was to the day. Like, watching the Cosby Show, I got messages and things out of that. And, you know, and it's. And even watching the Fat Albert, there were messages in that, the positive messages. So people do negative things. They need to pay for what they did. That's fine.
Yeah.
But, like, just leave people alone, like races. And I did a thing with, you know, I played in this little golf tournament with a LGBT friend of mine and some other people. And people are just people, man. We play golf. Ain't nobody tripping on nobody.
Right.
You know, and here's the other thing, especially, let me get back to race for 1 second. If you are a blatant racist and you claim you're a racist, then honestly, you need to be walking around this world butt naked with nothing, because the cars that you drive, the clothes that you wear, the food that you eat, everything about you and everything that you touch is by somebody that is not of your race.
That's for sure.
So if you're a racist, how can you survive on this planet and utilize anything?
Yeah.
Because it's touched by people that aren't you. So just let it go. Give it up.
I hear you.
Yeah.
Okay. If you could wake up tomorrow having gained any quality or ability, what would it be?
To end violence and racism, man. That's me. You know what I'm saying? Like,
that's what's up.
I have to. To this day, I got to watch my back, man, when it comes to just going out. People, you know, worry about my safety as a black man and in a nice car and in a nice neighborhood. Like, just be careful.
Yeah.
Why should I have to be careful?
That's
but
right.
I do. Like, I've conditioned myself to dress a certain way,
sure,
to talk a certain way. When I walk into a store knowing that I got a ton of money in my pocket or can buy anything in the store, I'll give you a perfect example. I went to Walmart and I got my birthday, got some people coming through, whatever. I grab a bottle of alcohol, and I'm walking around the store with a bottle. I don't even drink, so this is for other people. I got a bottle of alcohol in my hand, but I'm looking at other stuff. I got to get, you know, some soap and some toothpaste. And other, but I'm walking around with this bottle of alcohol. And in the back of my head, I'm like, they're watching me. I got to make sure that I go take care of this because they're probably looking like, is he going to walk out with the alcohol?
Right, right, right.
I shouldn't even have to think that way, but I do.
Yeah.
Because I've been stopped before just walking around and somebody asked me, can I help you? What? Help me with what? I'm buying stuff. You know, what are you buying? Like, who are you? Like, oh, I'm undercover with the store. Like, man, what you get away from me, dude? You want to come work for me? You know what I'm saying? Like, leave me alone. I ain't do nothing.
For sure.
It's just crazy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I got to ask. This is not part of my lightning round. I forgot, though. But, you know, I know you have a complicated history with it, but is there a favorite memory of Easy?
Yeah, I always tell this story, man, and people don't know. Easy used to walk around with honey buns in his back pocket. You ever hear that one?
Nah.
Yeah, we used to go do shows, and Easy was one of them cats that didn't like to stop nowhere. Like, man, let's just go. And we'd be hungry. Like, man, can we stop, get some food? No, go ahead. We'll eat when we get there. But he would take honey buns and put them in his back pockets, like two or four of them, had two in each back pocket, and they would get all squished down like this. But you hear that fool in the back of the van, like, opening up honey buns. Like, God damn, man, it's the craziest thing. And that's what I remember. The other stuff I remember I can't talk about.
Right.
Because it's crazy.
Of course.
But, yeah.
I remember the pool parties and...
Pool parties and just... That fool was crazy. Yeah. I'll tell you that. He wouldn't nobody be messed with. You know, as little as he was, he wasn't nobody to be messed with.
Now, I met him a few times, and, you know, the Ruthless Cats were friends of mine.
Yeah.
And he's one of the few people that, like, you know, he had no reason to pay me any attention whatsoever, and he was just the coolest.
Oh, coolest dude you want to meet. Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, and I think, you know, I think him and his personality is a big part of why we are where we are today as far as rap music and culture.
Yeah.
I think Easy, and I'm not... Not to discount everybody else who contributed to that, including you.
Right, right.
Right, but I think his personality, just the hugeness of who he was, changed the world.
Oh, it did. Yeah, for sure.
Okay, last one. If I worked for you, if I was on your team, one of your startups, whatever, what's something I would hear you say over and over again?
Take care of your business. Honestly, take care of your, as a startup, you got to take care of your business, because you can have a product, but if you don't have your business taken care of, your product will never come to light, period. And that's the most important thing. I think people focus too much on getting the money and building a product. But where's your business model? Where's your sustainability?
Sure.
Where's the marketing plan? Where's everything that goes into selling it? You can spend all this money. Okay, we're going to go there. Magic Leap. Oh, shit. Let's talk about Magic Leap. Like, I know some people they got $3 billion?
Yeah.
And I've heard that they laid off 1,000 people recently. Yeah. They're going under, and hopefully they've got another $350 million. Like, who keep throwing money at that? It's VR. It's augmented reality. It's not like, they're putting people on the moon for $3 billion.
Crazy. Okay. I mean, I'm with you.
Yeah.
But there's some people that say, you know, you look at Facebook, you look at, whoever else, right, who figured that business model out along the way.
Yeah.
And that's one of the mantras in Silicon Valley, right, or in the tech world, is like, it's okay if you don't have all that figured out, because build something great, you'll pivot, blah, 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 blah. And so how do you balance those two?
Well, I do say this, you know, in order to succeed, sometimes you got to fail.
Mm-hmm.
I believe in that wholeheartedly.
Mm-hmm.
But in an informational technology the information world that we live in, there is no reason that you can't take care of your business and have that. Like, yeah, you can figure it out as you go. Everybody does.
Sure.
I even do it to this day. But people forget about the business and just focus too much on that. And, you know, I often talk about the Facebooks and Instagrams and the Snapchats in my talks with people. And I say this, don't try to do too much in tech either. Because as a startup, what are you trying to make? A product that's going to make you money,
mm-hmm.
right? look at the biggest companies on this planet. Most of them, Facebook, Instagram, Snapchat, WeChat, you know, all of those all use the same exact thing.
Right.
Freaking text, photos,
yeah,
and video in different ways.
Right.
And they're all successful companies. They kept it simple. They figured out a market and attacked that market. If you do something that's too difficult or too, you know, too many appendages and things on it, it could be hard to sell. It could be a hard sell. The Pet Rock still sells to this day. The Slinky still sells to this day. The freaking Chia Pet still sells to this day.
Yeah.
And, you know, you just got to find a niche and roll with it.
Yeah. Yeah, that's interesting. And you know, even bringing it back to music, like I think of, you know, Run DMC rapping over a drum machine.
Boom. Too short. You know what I mean? Rapping over a beat.
Yeah.
Pretty much. And a bass line. That's it.
Yeah.
Supersonic, man. When I did Supersonic.
Yeah.
Did two songs for $400 in the studio. The girls weren't rappers. Just some friends of ours.
Right.
I was working on my Professor X stuff, and they just happened to be in the studio. Knocked out two songs in 4 hours. All I had in the studio was a 808 drum machine and a Yamaha DX7, and that was Supersonic. And to this day, it still sells.
For sure.
Still, you know, like...
Who wrote that fast-ass part of the rap?
The girls did.
Oh, they wrote it?
Yeah.
Okay.
And Juana, I think Juana wrote that whole style, and then her and Dania.
I mean, that was a game-changer.
Game-changer, like, right?
You know, no one ever heard somebody rap
Like that. And then Eminem put it on Rap God. Yeah. I was like, damn. All right, Em.
For sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's amazing, man. Those great lessons. Yes, dude, sir. Thanks for sharing this with me, man.
Nah, thanks for having me. It's cool to walk like right next door.
Oh, yeah, no doubt. Well, let's do it again, man.
Yeah.
I'd love to. How's everybody find you online?
OG Arabian Prince on social, you know, and then my company is Innovate Next, INOV, the number 8, NEXT.com, and then we got the new Covatech thing. But I'm out there, man. I'm, you know, launching video game products and tech products, doing a lot in esports. So I'm out there.
And for, like, small businesses that want to get involved with Covatech, how does that work?
Just reach out to Covatech.us.
Okay.
That's us.
Dope.
Yeah.
Dope. Thank you, man.
Cool. Appreciate it.
Yo, that was Arabian Prince on Rebel Radio. I hope you enjoyed it. I know I did. Leave us a comment. Hit us up on Twitter or on Facebook at Rebel Radio Net. You can leave us reviews on iTunes. You can come back next week if you want to hear more Rebel Radio. Peace.